What is Man? By Mark Twain. An adult brain audiobook production read to you by Graham Dunlop. Chapter 1. A. Man the Machine. B. Personal Merit. The old man and the young man had been conversing. The old man had asserted that the human being is merely a machine and nothing more. The young man objected and asked him to go into particulars and furnish his reasons for his position. Old man.
What are the materials of which a steam engine is made?
Young man. Iron, steel, brass, white metal, and so on. Old man.
Where are these found?
Young man. In the rocks.
In a pure state?
No, in ores.
Are the metals suddenly deposited in the ores?
No. It is the patient work of countless ages.
You could make the engine out of the rocks themselves?
Yes, a brittle one and not valuable.
You would not require much of such an engine as that?
No, substantially nothing.
To make a fine and capable engine, how would you proceed?
Drive tunnels and shafts into the hills, blast out the iron ore, crush it, smelt it, reduce it to pig iron, put some of it through the Bessemer process, and make steel of it. Mine and treat and combine the several metals of which brass is made.
Then?
Out of the perfected result, build the fine engine.
You would require much of this one?
Oh, indeed, yes.
It could drive lathes. Drills, planers, punches, polishers, in a word, all the cunning machines of a great factory?
It could.
What could the stone engine do?
Drive a sewing machine, possibly. Nothing more, perhaps.
Men would admire the other engine and rapturously praise it?
Yes.
But not the stone one?
No.
The merits of the metal machine would be far above those of the stone one?
Of course.
Personal merits?
Personal merits? How do you mean?
It would be personally entitled to the credit of its own performance?
The engine? Certainly not.
Why not?
Because its performance is not personal. It is a result of the law of its construction. It is not a merit that it does the things which it is set to do. It can't help doing them.
And is it not a personal demerit in the stone machine that it does so little?
Certainly not. It does no more and no less than the law of its make permits and compels it to do. There is nothing personal about it. It cannot choose. In this process of working up to the matter, is it your idea to work up to the proposition that man and a machine are about the same thing, and that there is no personal merit in the performance of either?
Yes, but do not be offended. I'm meaning no offense. What makes the grand difference between the stone engine and the steel one? Shall we call it training, education? Shall we call the stone engine a savage and the steel one a civilized man? The original rock contained the stuff of which the steel one was built, but along with it a lot of sulfur and stone and other obstructing, inborn heredities brought down from the old geologic ages, prejudices, let us call them. Prejudices which nothing within the rock itself had either power to remove or any desire to remove. Will you take note of that phrase?
Yes, I have written it down. Prejudices with nothing within the rock itself had either power to remove or any desire to remove. Go on.
Prejudices which must be removed by outside influences or not at all. Put that down.
Very well. Must be removed by outside influences or not at all. Go on.
The iron's prejudice against ridding itself of the cumbering rock, to make it more exact, the iron's absolute indifference as to whether the rock be removed or not. Then comes the outside influence and grinds the rock to powder and sets the ore free. The iron in the ore is still captive. An outside influence smelts it free of the clogging ore. The iron is emancipated iron, now but different to further progress. An outside influence beguiles it into the Bessemer furnace and refines it into the steel of the first quality. It is educated now, its training is complete, and it has reached its limit. By no possible process can it be educated into gold. Will you set that down?
Yes. Everything has its limit. Iron ore cannot be educated into gold.
There are gold men and tin men and copper men and leaden men and steel men and so on, and each has the limitations of his nature, his heredities, his training, and his environment. You can build engines out of each of these metals, and they will all perform, but you must not require the weak ones to do equal work with the strong ones. In each case, to get the best results, you must free the metal from its obstructing prejudicial ores by education, smelting, refining, and so forth.
You have arrived at man now?
Yes. Man the machine. Man the impersonal engine. Whatsoever a man is due to his make and the influences brought to bear upon it by his heredities, his habitat, his associations. He is moved, directed, commanded by exterior influences solely. He originates nothing, not even a thought.
Oh, come. Where did I get my opinion that this which you are talking is all foolishness?
It is quite a natural opinion. Indeed, an inevitable opinion, but you did not create the materials out of which it is formed. There are odds and ends of thoughts, impressions, feelings gathered unconsciously from 1,000 books, 1,000 conversations, and from streams of thought and feeling which have flowed down into your heart and brain, out of the hearts and brains of centuries of ancestors. Personally, you do not create even the smallest microscopic fragment of the materials out of which your opinion is made. And personally, you cannot claim even the slender merit of putting the borrowed materials together. That was done automatically by your mental machinery in strict accordance with the law of that machinery's construction. And you not only did not make that machinery yourself, but you have not even any command over it.
This is too much. You think I could have formed no opinion but that one?
Spontaneously? No. And you did not form that one. Your machinery did it for you, automatically and instantly, without reflection or the need of it.
Suppose I had reflected. How then?
Suppose you try.
After a quarter of an hour, I have reflected.
You mean you have tried to change your opinion? As an experiment?
Yes.
With success?
No. It remains the same. It is impossible to change it.
I am sorry, but you see yourself that your mind is merely a machine, nothing more. You have no command over it. It has no command over itself. It is worked solely from the outside. This is the law of its make. It is the law of all machines.
Can't I ever change one of these automatic opinions?
No, you can't yourself, but exterior influences can do it.
And exterior ones only?
Yes, exterior ones only.
That position is untenable. I may say ludicrously untenable.
What makes you think so?
I don't merely think it, I know it. Suppose I resolve to enter upon a course of thought and study and reading with the deliberate purpose of changing that opinion. And suppose I succeed. That is not the work of an exterior impulse. The whole of it is mine and personal, for I originated the project.
Not a shred of it. It grew out of this talk with me. But for that, it would never have occurred to you. No man ever originates anything. All his thoughts, all his impulses come from the outside.
It's an exasperating subject. The first man had original thoughts anyway. There was nobody to draw from.
It is a mistake. Adam's thoughts came to him from the outside. You have a fear of death. You did not invent that. You got it from outside, from talking and teaching. Adam had no fear of death, none in the world.
Yes, he had.
When he was created?
No.
When then?
When he was threatened with it.
Then it came from the outside. Adam is quite big enough. Let us not try to make a god of him. None but gods have ever had a thought of which did not come from the outside. Adam probably had a good head, but it was no sort of use to him until it was filled up from the outside. He was not able to invent the triflingest little thing with it. He had not a shadow of a notion of the difference between good and evil. He had to get the idea from the outside. Neither he nor Eve was able to originate the idea that it was immodest to go naked. The knowledge came in with the apple from the outside. A man's brain is so constructed that it can originate nothing whatever. It can only use material obtained outside. It is merely a machine, and it works automatically, not by willpower. It has no command over itself. Its owner has no command over it.
Well, never mind Adam, but certainly Shakespeare's creations.
No, you mean Shakespeare's imitations? Shakespeare created nothing. He correctly observed and he marvelously painted. He exactly portrayed people whom God had created. But he created none himself. Let us spare him the slander of charging him with trying. Shakespeare could not create. He was a machine, and machines do not create.
Where was his excellence then?
In this. He was not a sewing machine like you and me. He was a Gobelin loom. The threads and the colors came into him from the outside. Outside influences, suggestions, experiences, reading, seeing plays, playing plays, borrowing ideas, and so on, framed the patterns in his mind and started up its complex and admirable machinery, and it automatically turned out that pictured and gorgeous fabric which still compels the astonishment of the world. If Shakespeare had been born and bred on a barren and unvisited rock in the ocean, his mighty intellect would have had no outside material to work with, and could have invented none, and no outside influences, teachings, moldings, persuasions, inspirations of a valuable sort, and could have invented none. And so Shakespeare would have produced nothing. In Turkey, he would have produced something. Something up to the highest limit of Turkish influences, associations, and training. In France, he would have produced something better, something up to the highest limit of the French influences and training. In England, he rose to the highest limit attainable to the outside helps afforded by that land's ideals, influences, and training. You and I are but sewing machines. We must turn out what we can. We must do our endeavor and care nothing at all when the unthinking reproach us for not turning out Gobelins.
And so we are mere machines. And machines may not boast, nor feel proud of their performance, nor claim personal merit for it, nor applause and praise. It is an infamous doctrine.
It isn't a doctrine, it's merely a fact.
I suppose, then, there is no more merit in being brave than in being a coward?
Personal merit? No. A brave man does not create his bravery. He is entitled to no personal credit for possessing it. It is born to him. A baby born with $1 billion, where is the personal merit in that? A baby born with nothing, where is the personal demerit in that? The one is fawned upon, admired, worshipped by sycophants. The other is neglected and despised. Where is the sense in it?
Sometimes a timid man sets himself the task of conquering his cowardice and becoming brave, and succeeds. What do you say to that?
That it shows the value of training in right directions over training in wrong ones. Inestimably valuable is training, influence, education in right directions, training one's self-approbation to elevate its ideals.
But as to merit, the personal merit of the victorious coward's project and achievement?
There isn't any. In the world's view, he is a worthier man than he was before, but he didn't achieve the change. The merit of it is not his.
Whose then?
His make. and the influences which wrought upon it from the outside.
His make?
To start with, he was not utterly and completely a coward, or the influences would have had nothing to work upon. He was not afraid of a cow, though perhaps of a bull. Not afraid of a woman, but afraid of a man. There was something to build upon. There was a seed. No seed, no plant. Did he make that seed himself, or was it born in him? It was no merit of his that the seed was there.
Well, anyway, the idea of cultivating it, the resolution to cultivate it, was meritorious, and he originated that.
He did nothing of the kind. It came whence all impulses, good or bad, come, from outside. If that timid man had lived all his life in a community of human rabbits, had never read of brave deeds, had never heard speak of them, had never heard anyone praise them, nor express envy of the heroes that had done them, he would have had no more idea of bravery than Adam had of modesty. And it could never by any possibility have occurred to him to resolve to become brave. He could not originate the idea. It had to come to him from the outside. And so, when he heard bravery extolled and cowardice derided, it woke him up. He was ashamed. Perhaps his sweetheart turned up her nose and said, "I am told that you are a coward." It was not he that turned over the new leaf. She did it for him. He must not strut around in the merit of it. It is not his.
But anyway, he reared the plant after she watered the seed.
No. Outside influences reared it. At the command and trembling, he marched out into the field, with the other soldiers and in the daytime, not alone and in the dark. He had the influence of example. He drew courage from his comrades' courage. He was afraid and wanted to run, but he did not dare. He was afraid to run, with all those soldiers looking on. He was progressing, you see. The moral fear of shame had risen superior to the physical fear of harm. By the end of the campaign, experience will have taught him that not all who go into battle get hurt, an outside influence which will be helpful to him. And he will also have learned how sweet it is to be praised for courage and be huzzaed at with tear-choked voices as the war-worn regiment marches past the worshipping multitude with flags flying and the drums beating. After that, he will be as securely brave as any veteran in the army, and there will not be a shade nor suggestion of personal merit in it anywhere. It will all have come from the outside. The Victoria Cross breeds more heroes than...
Hang it. Where is the sense in his becoming brave if he is to get no credit for it?
Your question will answer itself presently. It involves an important detail of man's make, which we have not yet touched upon.
What detail is that?
The impulse which moves a person to do things. The only impulse that ever moves a person to do a thing.
The only one? Is there but one?
That is all. There is only one.
Well, certainly that is a strange enough doctrine. What is the sole impulse that ever moves a person to do a thing?
The impulse to content his own spirit. The necessity of contenting his own spirit and winning its approval.
Oh, come. That won't do.
Why won't it?
Because it puts him in the attitude of always looking out for his own comfort and advantage, whereas an unselfish man often does a thing solely for another person's good, when it is a positive disadvantage to himself.
It is a mistake. The act must do him good first, otherwise he will not do it. He may think he is doing it solely for the other person's sake, but it is not so. He is contenting his own spirit first. The other person's benefit has to always take second place.
What a fantastic idea. What becomes of self-sacrifice? Please answer me that.
What is self-sacrifice?
The doing good to another person where no shadow nor suggestion of benefit to oneself can result from it. Chapter 2. Man's sole impulse, the securing of his own approval. Old man.
There have been instances of it, you think?
Young man, instances? Millions of them.
You have not jumped to conclusions? You have examined them critically?
They don't need it. The acts themselves reveal the golden impulse back of them.
For instance?
Well then, for instance, take the case in the book here. The man lives 3 miles uptown. It is bitter cold, snowing hard, midnight. He is about to enter the horse car when a gray and ragged old woman, a touching picture of misery, puts out her lean hand and begs for rescue from hunger and death. The man finds that he has but a quarter in his pocket, but he does not hesitate. He gives it her and trudges home through the storm. There, it is noble, it is beautiful, its grace is marred by no fleck or blemish or suggestion of self-interest.
What makes you think that?
Pray, what else could I think? Do you imagine that there is some other way of looking at it?
Can you put yourself in the man's place and tell me what he felt and what he thought?
Easily. The sight of that suffering old face pierced his generous heart with a sharp pain. He could not bear it. He could endure the 3 mile walk in the storm, but he could not endure the tortures his conscience would suffer if he turned his back and left that poor old creature to perish. He would not have been able to sleep for thinking of it.
What was his state of mind on his way home?
It was a state of joy which only the self-sacrificer knows. His heart sang. He was unconscious of the storm.
He felt well?
One cannot doubt it.
Very well. Now let us add up the details and see how much he got for his 25 cents. Let us try to find out the real why of his making the investment. In the first place, he couldn't bear the pain which the old suffering face gave him. So he was thinking of his pain, this good man. He must buy a salve for it. If he did not succor the old woman, his conscience would torture him all the way home. Thinking of his pain again, he must buy relief from that. If he didn't relieve the old woman, he would not get any sleep. He must buy some sleep, still thinking of himself, you see. Thus, to sum up, he bought himself free of a sharp pain in his heart. He bought himself free of the tortures of a waiting conscience. He bought a whole night's sleep, all for 25 cents. It should make Wall Street ashamed of itself. On his way home, his heart was joyful, and it sang, profit on top of profit. The impulse which moved the man to succor the old woman was, first, to content his own spirit, secondly, to relieve her sufferings. Is it your opinion that men's acts proceed from one central and unchanging and inalterable impulse, or from a variety of impulses?
From a variety, of course. Some high and fine and noble, others not. What is your opinion?
Then there is but one law, one source.
That both the noblest impulses and the basest proceed from that one source?
Yes.
Will you put that law into words?
Yes. This is the law. Keep it in your mind. From his cradle to his grave, a man never does a single thing which has any first and foremost object but one, to secure peace of mind, spiritual comfort for himself.
Come. He never does anything for anyone else's comfort, spiritual or physical?
No, except on those distinct terms. That it shall first secure his own spiritual comfort, otherwise he will not do it.
It will be easy to expose the falsity of that proposition.
For instance?
Take that noble passion, love of country, patriotism. A man who loves peace and dreads pain, leaves his pleasant home and his weeping family, and marches out to manfully expose himself to hunger, cold, wounds, and death. Is that seeking spiritual comfort?
He loves peace and dreads pain?
Yes.
Then perhaps there is something that he loves more than he loves peace, the approval of his neighbors and the public. And perhaps there is something which he dreads more than he dreads pain, the disapproval of his neighbors and the public. If he is sensitive to shame, he will go to the field, not because his spirit will be entirely comfortable there, but because it will be more comfortable there than it would be if he remained at home. He will always do the thing which will bring him the most mental comfort, for that is the sole law of his life. He leaves the weeping family behind. He is sorry to make them uncomfortable, but not sorry enough to sacrifice his own comfort to secure theirs.
Do you really believe that mere public opinion could force a timid and peaceful man to...
go to war? Yes. Public opinion can force some men to do anything.
Anything?
Yes. Anything.
I don't believe that. Can it force a right-principled man to do a wrong thing?
Yes.
Can it force a kind man to do a cruel thing?
Yes.
Give me an instance.
Alexander Hamilton was a conspicuously high-principled man. He regarded dueling as wrong and as opposed to the teachings of religion. But in deference to public opinion, he fought a duel. He deeply loved his family, but to buy public approval, he treacherously deserted them and threw his life away, ungenerously leaving them to lifelong sorrow in order that he might stand well with a foolish world. In the then condition of the public standards of honor, he could not have been comfortable with the stigma upon him of having refused to fight. The teachings of religion, his devotion to his family, his kindness of heart, his high principles all went for nothing when they stood in the way of his spiritual comfort. A man will do anything, no matter what it is, to secure his spiritual comfort, and he can neither be forced nor persuaded to any act which has not that goal for its object. Hamilton's act was compelled by the inborn necessity of contenting his own spirit. In this it was like all the other acts of his life, and like all the acts of all men's lives. Do you see where the kernel of the matter lies? A man cannot be comfortable without his own approval. He will secure the largest share possible of that at all costs, all sacrifices.
A minute ago you said Hamilton fought that duel to get public approval.
I did. By refusing to fight the duel, he would have secured his family's approval and a large share of his own. But the public approval was more valuable in his eyes than all other approvals put together, in the earth or above it. To secure that would furnish him the most comfort of mind, the most self-approval. So he sacrificed all other values to get it.
Some noble souls have refused to fight duels and have manfully braved the public contempt.
They acted according to their make. They valued their principles and the approval of their families above the public approval. They took the thing they valued most and let the rest go. They took what would give them the largest share of personal contentment and approval. A man always does. Public opinion cannot force that kind of man to go to the wars. When they go, it is for other reasons, other spirit-contenting reasons.
Always spirit-contenting reasons?
There are no others.
When a man sacrifices his life to save a little child from a burning building, what do you call that?
When he does it, it is the law of his make. He can't bear to see the child in that peril. A man of a different make could. So he tries to save the child and loses his life. But he has got what he was after, his own approval.
What do you call love, hate, charity, revenge, humanity, magnanimity, forgiveness?
Different results of the one master impulse, the necessity of securing one's self-approval. They wear diverse clothes and are subject to diverse moods, but in whatsoever ways they masquerade, they are the same person all the time. To change the figure, the compulsion that moves a man, and there is but one, is the necessity of securing the contentment of his own spirit. When it stops, the man is dead.
This is foolishness. Love.
Why? Love is that impulse, that law, in its most uncompromising form. It will squander life and everything else on its object, not primarily for the object's sake, but for its own. When its object is happy, it is happy. And that is what it is unconsciously after.
You do not even accept the lofty and gracious passion of mother love?
No, it is the absolute slave of that law. The mother will go naked to clothe her child. She will starve that it may have food, suffer torture to save it from pain, die that it may live. She takes a living pleasure in making these sacrifices. She does it for that reward, that self-approval, that contentment, that peace, that comfort. She would do it for your child if she could get the same pay.
This is an infernal philosophy of yours.
It isn't a philosophy. It is a fact.
Of course, you must admit that there are some acts which...
No. There is no act, large or small, fine or mean, which springs from any motive but the one, the necessity of appeasing and contenting one's own spirit.
The world's philanthropists.
I honor them. I uncover my head to them, from habit and training, but they could not know comfort or happiness or self-approval if they did not work and spend for the unfortunate. It makes them happy to see others happy. And so with money and labor, they buy what they are after, happiness, self-approval. Why don't misers do the same? Because they can't get a thousandfold more happiness by not doing it. There is no other reason. They followed the law of their make.
What do you say of duty for duty's sake?
That it does not exist. Duties are not performed for duty's sake, but because their neglect would make the man uncomfortable. A man performs but one duty, the duty of contenting his spirit, the duty of making himself agreeable to himself. If he can most satisfyingly perform the sole and only duty by helping his neighbor, he will do it. If he can most satisfyingly perform it by swindling his neighbor, he will do that. But he always looks out for number one, first. The effects upon others are a secondary matter. Men pretend to self-sacrifices, but this is a thing which, in the ordinary value of the phrase, does not exist and has not existed. A man often honestly thinks he is sacrificing himself merely and solely for someone else, but he is deceived. His bottom impulse is to content a requirement of his nature and training, and thus acquire peace for his soul.
Apparently, then, all men, both good and bad ones, devote their lives to contenting their consciences?
Yes, that is a good enough name for it, conscience. That independent sovereign, that insolent absolute monarch inside of a man who is the man's master. There are all kinds of consciences, because there are all kinds of men. You satisfy an assassin's conscience in one way, a philanthropist's in another, a miser's in another, a burglar's in still another. As a guide or incentive to any authoritatively prescribed line of morals or conduct, leaving training out of the account, a man's conscience is totally valueless. I know a kind-hearted Kentuckian whose self-approval was lacking, whose conscience was troubling him, to phrase it with exactness, because he had neglected to kill a certain man, a man whom he had never seen. The stranger had killed this man's friend in a fight. This man's Kentucky training made it a duty to kill the stranger for it. He neglected his duty, kept dodging it, shirking it, putting it off, and his unrelenting conscience kept persecuting him for this conduct. At last, to get ease of mind, comfort, self-approval, he hunted up the stranger and took his life. It was an immense act of self-sacrifice, as per the usual definition, for he did not want to do it, and he never would have done it, if he could have bought a contented spirit and an unworried mind at smaller cost. But we are so made that we will pay anything for that contentment, even another man's life.
You spoke a moment ago of trained consciences. You mean that we are not born with consciences competent to guide us aright?
If we were, children and savages would know right from wrong and not have to be taught it.
But consciences can be trained?
Yes.
Of course, by parents, teachers, the pulpit, and books.
Yes. They do their share. They do what they can.
And the rest is done by?
Oh, a million unnoticed influences, for good or bad. Influences which work without rest during every waking moment of a man's life, from cradle to grave.
You have tabulated these?
Many of them, yes.
Will you read me the result?
Another time, yes. It would take an hour.
A conscience can be trained to shun evil and prefer good.
Yes.
But will prefer it for spirit-contenting reasons only?
It can't be trained to do a thing for any other reason. The thing is impossible.
There must be a genuinely and utterly self-sacrificing act recorded in human history somewhere.
You are young. You have many years before you. Search one out.
It does seem to me that when a man sees a fellow being struggling in the water and jumps in at the risk of his life to save him...
Wait. Describe the man. Describe the fellow being. State if there is an audience present or if they are alone.
What have these things to do with the splendid act?
Very much. Shall we suppose, as a beginning, that the two are alone in a solitary place at midnight?
If you choose.
And that the fellow being is the man's daughter?
Well, no, make it someone else.
A filthy, drunken ruffian, then?
I see. Circumstances alter cases. I suppose that if there was no audience to observe the act, the man wouldn't perform it.
But there is here and there a man who would. People, for instance, like the man who lost his life trying to save the child from the fire, and the man who gave the needy old woman his 25 cents and walked home in the storm. There are here and there men like that who would do it. And why? Because they couldn't bear to see a fellow being struggling in the water and not jump in to help. It would give them pain. They would save the fellow being on that account. They wouldn't do it otherwise. They strictly obey the law, which I have been insisting upon. You must remember and always distinguish the people who can't bear things from the people who can. It will throw light upon a number of apparently self-sacrificing cases.
Oh dear, it's all so disgusting.
Yes, and so true.
Come, take the boy who does things he doesn't want to do in order to gratify his mother.
He does 7/10 of the act because it gratifies him to gratify his mother. Throw the bulk of advantage the other way and the good boy would not do the act. He must obey the iron law. None can escape it.
Well, take the case of a bad boy who...
You needn't mention it. It is a waste of time. It is no matter about the bad boy's act. Whatever it was, he had a spirit-contenting reason for it. Otherwise, you have been misinformed, and he didn't do it.
It is very exasperating. A while ago, you said that a man's conscience is not a born judge of morals and conduct, but has to be taught and trained. Now, I think a conscience can get drowsy and lazy, but I don't think it can go wrong. And if you wake it up... A little story.
I will tell you a little story. Once upon a time, an infidel was guest in the house of a Christian widow whose little boy was ill and near to death. The infidel often watched by the bedside and entertained the boy with talk, and he used these opportunities to satisfy a strong longing of his nature, that desire which is in us all to better other people's condition by having them think as we think. He was successful. But the dying boy, in his last moments, reproached him and said, "I believed and was happy in it. You have taken my belief away and my comfort. Now I have nothing left, and I die miserable. For the things which you have told me do not take the place of that which I have lost." And the mother also reproached the infidel and said, "My child is forever lost, and my heart is broken. How could you do this cruel thing? We have done you no harm, but only kindness. We made our house your home. You were welcome to all we had, and this is our reward." The heart of the infidel was filled with remorse for what he had done, and he said, "I was wrong. I see it now. But I was only trying to do him good. In my view, he was in error. It seemed my duty to teach him the truth." Then the mother said, "I had taught him all his little life what I believed to be the truth. And in his believing faith, both of us were happy. Now he is dead and lost, and I am miserable. Our faith come down to us through centuries of believing ancestors. What right had you or anyone to disturb it? Where was your honor? Where was your shame?"
"He was a miscreant and deserved death."
"He thought so himself and said so."
"Ah, you see, his conscience was awakened."
"Yes, his self-disapproval was. It pained him to see the mother suffer. He was sorry he had done a thing which brought him pain. It did not occur to him to think of the mother when he was misteaching the boy, for he was absorbed in providing pleasure for himself then, providing it by satisfying what he believed to be a call of duty."
"Call it what you please. It is to me a case of awakened conscience. That awakened conscience could never get itself into that species of trouble again. A cure like that is a permanent cure.
Pardon? I had not finished the story. We are creatures of outside influences. We originate nothing within. Whenever we take a new line of thought and drift into a new line of belief and action, the impulse is always suggested from the outside. Remorse so preyed upon the infidel that it dissolved his harshness toward the boy's religion and made him come to regard it with tolerance, next with kindness, for the boy's sake and the mother's. Finally, he found himself examining it. From that moment, his progress to his new trend was steady and rapid. He became a believing Christian, and now his remorse for having robbed the dying boy of his faith and his salvation was bitterer than ever. It gave him no rest, no peace. He must have rest and peace. It is the law of our nature. There seemed but one way to get it. He must devote himself to saving imperiled souls. He became a missionary. He landed in a pagan country, ill and helpless. A native widow took him into her humble home and nursed him back to convalescence. Then her young boy was taken hopelessly ill, and the grateful missionary helped her tend him. Here was his first opportunity to repair a part of the wrong done to the other boy by doing a precious service for this one by undermining his foolish faith in his false gods. He was successful, but the dying boy in his last moments reproached him and said, "I believed and was happy in it. You have taken my belief away and my comfort. Now I have nothing left, and I die miserable, for the things which you have told me do not take this place of that which I have lost." And the mother also reproached the missionary and said, "My child is forever lost, and my heart is broken. How could you do this cruel thing? We had done you no harm, but only kindness. We made our house your home. You were welcome to all we had, and this is our reward." The heart of the missionary was filled with remorse for what he had done, and he said, "I was wrong. I see it now. But I was only trying to do him good. In my view, he was in error. It seemed my duty to teach him the truth." Then the mother said, "I had taught him all his little life what I believed to be the truth. And in his believing faith, both of us were happy. Now he is dead and lost. And I am miserable. Our faith came down to us through centuries of believing ancestors. What right had you or anyone to disturb it? Where was your honor? Where was your shame?" The missionary's anguish of remorse and sense of treachery were as bitter and persecuting and unappeasable now as they had been in the former case. The story is finished. What is your comment?
The man's conscience was a fool. It was morbid. It didn't know right from wrong.
I am sorry to hear you say that. If you grant that one man's conscience doesn't know right from wrong, it is an admission that there are others like it. This single admission pulls down the whole doctrine of infallibility of judgment in consciences. Meantime, there is one thing which I ask you to notice.
What is that?
That in both cases, a man's act gave him no spiritual discomfort, and that he was quite satisfied with it and got pleasures out of it. But afterward, when it resulted in pain to him, he was sorry. Sorry it had inflicted pain upon the others, but for no reason under the sun except that their pain gave him pain. Our consciences take notice of pain inflicted upon others until it reaches a point where it gives pains to us. In all cases, without exception, we are absolutely indifferent to another person's pain until his sufferings make us uncomfortable. Many an infidel would not have been troubled by that Christian mother's distress. Do you believe that?
Yes. You might almost say it of the average infidel, I think.
And many a missionary, sternly fortified by his sense of duty, would not have been troubled by the pagan mother's distress. Jesuit missionaries in Canada, in the early French times, for instance. See episodes quoted by Parkman.
Well, let us adjourn. Where have we arrived?
At this, that we, mankind, have ticketed ourselves with a number of qualities to which we have given misleading names. Love, hate, charity, compassion, avarice, benevolence, and so on. I mean, we attach misleading meanings to the names. They are all forms of self-contentment, self-gratification, but the names so disguise them that they distract our attention from the fact. Also, we have smuggled a word into the dictionary which ought not to be there at all. Self-sacrifice. It describes a thing which does not exist. But worst of all, we ignore and never mention the soul impulse which dictates and compels a man's every act, the imperious necessity of securing his own approval in every emergency and at all costs. To it we owe all that we are. It is our breath, our heart, our blood. It is our only spur, our whip, our goad, our only impelling power. We have no other. Without it, we should be mere inert images, corpses. No one would do anything. There would be no progress. The world would stand still. We ought to stand reverently uncovered when the name of that stupendous power is uttered.
I am not convinced.
You will be when you think.
Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.